Okay, thank you. So, hi everybody, welcome along Tuesday morning, and those online, thank you for being here. So we'll begin as we normally do by doing a short meditation. We'll say some prayers together, and I'll come up on the screen up there, and then we'll actually begin the course, and I'll explain what happens to that course when we get to that. So please, just make yourselves comfortable in your seat. This means that your back should be straight, your shoulders relaxed. You can place your hands wherever you like. And you can keep your eyes open or close them completely, or even see them slightly open. And when you're comfortable in your seat, just let your body breathe itself. So you're sitting comfortably. You're relaxing, and the body is breathing itself. And feeling the body breathe itself, relax into awareness. And from that state of awareness, imagine that the ground that your feet are resting upon is made of starry sapphire light, as soft as the palm of a baby's hand. And the space around you is filled with rainbows and offerings from gods and men. And in the space in front of you, on a lion throne, an official of lotus, sun and moon, sits the Buddha. And Buddha Shakyamuni is surrounded by other Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and deities and other enlightened beings. And you're sitting in front of the Buddha, and you are surrounded by enlightened beings. Your mother is beside you on the left, your father is beside you on the right. Your family and closest friends are sitting behind you, and people who don't like you, people you have difficulties with, are directly in front of you. And you're trying to realize your own Buddha nature, the deepest nature of the mind. And you think and appreciate how wonderful it is to be alive today and to have the leisure and opportunity to attain your spiritual goals. But you have to act quickly, because things are not quite right. Things don't exist as they seem to. While this is the case, you do have a spiritual friend leading you in the safe direction of the three rare sublime ones, the Buddha, his teaching, and his community. To make your offering of practice as purely as possible, see yourself to be as clear as a deity, holding the Vajra and Bell within a sphere of great bliss. And from within the sphere of great bliss, join me in saying, I go for refuge until I am enlightened through the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened through the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened through the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Now, from the heart of the Buddha and from every other enlightened being above you, lights and nectars stream down and dissolve into yourself and all living beings surrounding you. And these lights and nectars purify negative karma and obstructions. They increase your health and lifespan, your virtues and your realizations of the Dharma. And cleansed by wisdom and love, you recollect the four immeasurable thoughts, and you decide to develop these yourself and to establish every other being into those four immeasurable states. And so you say, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. But from the heart of each enlightened being, lights and nectar stream down. And these dissolve into yourself and all the living beings surrounding you. Negative behaviors and obstructions are purified. Your health and lifespan, your virtues and realizations of teachings are increased. So in the next exhalation, relax a little more. And from that relaxed state of awareness, invite the field for gathering energy, the field for accumulating merit, which appears. And you say, reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since the beginning of this time, and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own and others' merits to the great enlightenment. So you've purified your body, speech, and mind, and you've gathered some merit. To prevent yourself from clinging to this process as an intrinsically real, you imagine that your body, speech, and mind, your merit, and all of your enjoyments are utterly transformed into the enjoyments of a Buddha universe. And you offer this pure land to the Buddha, the Lama, and the spiritual entourage. And so you say, this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Buratamana Kamayataya. The offering has been made, and the Buddha accepts this offering and he smiles at you with delight. And you look up into the face of the Buddha and you meet his gaze. And in the eyes of the Buddha, you find immense humility, kindness, and acceptance. And from within the field for accumulated merit, your teacher comes to the crown of your head. And with you makes three requests to the lineage masters. So he asks that inspiring blessings pour down so that they quickly stop all perverse forms of mind, that you might quickly generate a pure mind, and all outer, inner, and secret obstructions are purified. And from the heart of each holy being, streams of light and nectar flow down, granting blessings and purifying. So green light and nectar wash over you. And you recollect the mind of renunciation, bodhicitta, and the correct view. But from the heart of the Buddha, infinite light rays emanate. These reach all environments and all beings, and everything dissolves into light. And this light dissolves into the Buddha, who dissolves into your teacher at the crown of your head. The teacher diminishes in size, becomes smaller and smaller. It enters through the crown of your head and descends down to your heart. The bare face of your innate mind, with the covering of the perception of true existence and perceiving that is true, vanishes. Your mind and the Lama become of one singular nature. In the absence of true existence, you hear the mantra. And within that absence, we recite the mantra. The true paths and the true cessations are actualized. And from your heart, rays of light fill the ten directions of space. And every living being abiding within space is utterly transformed into the fully awakened state. When the two purposes are achieved, their own enlightenment and the enlightenment of all beings. There's rest in the suchness. And from the ten directions of space, the light begins to return, entering your heart. You can feel the sleep beneath you. You can hear different sounds. You feel embodied. And you recollect that this meditation has been one of imagination. Nevertheless, it has imprinted the mind with this process. And so I think that you've put into place conditions for your full awakening. And understand that other conditions need to be gathered. You'll need to find yourself a teacher that you have faith and trust in. And you'll need to engage in each section of the path to enlightenment. So I think that you want to do this. You want to put an end to your own suffering, to develop all your good qualities, and to help others do the same. And this is why you've come along to this class today. And then breathe again through your nostrils. Exhale through your mouth, and let your eyes flutter open, and move yourself in the seat, get yourself comfortable, feel at ease. Okay, so welcome along to this course. So this course is called Well, this is cool. Death and rebirth. And it's made up, it's going to go over 9 weeks. We'll be talking about impermanence. That's what we're mainly talking about today. But over time, we'll go through the death process, 5 powerful methods you can bring to the process itself and how to live every day. And then we finally come to the topic called rebirth and the 6 different states you can be reborn into. But today's topics are focused on growth and subtle impermanence. And the second part of the teaching will focus on what they call the 8 worldly concerns. These 8 worldly concerns really stop you thinking about impermanence and death. And there are solutions for overcoming those 8 worldly concerns. So we'll be talking about those too. Now, information I've drawn on this course has come from previous teachings I've had myself, but these books today I'm using, there's this one up here in the corner called How to Practice Dharma. You can see Lama Zopa's face there. So I've drawn most of the material from the 8 worldly concerns, or the 8 worldly dharmas from that. And these 2 top books, one is called The Physical World, and the other is called The Foundation of Buddhist Practice. So it's those 3 books mainly. How to overcome the 8 worldly concerns I've relied upon Insight into Emptiness and Lojong. We have all of these books in the library. So let's begin by talking about impermanence first of all. And what we can do first of all, ask ourselves, like, what is it? And simply, the answer is that which is momentary. So what does even that mean? So the 2 phenomena that are momentary, that are most important to us, is the mind itself and everything physical. So if you look at your body, it's physical. It exists in moments through time. So everything that makes up your body depends upon causes and conditions for it to be here. And those causes and conditions are disintegrating. They're momentary. Nothing within your body is permanent. Nothing whatsoever. So we know this because we are growing from day to day, from year to year. And somewhere along the line, we're going to die and we'll vanish, just like everybody else has done. That's what we mean by momentariness. Nothing is stable. If you look at your mind, it's the same thing. Thoughts come and go. The mind is never stable. It also changes from moment to moment to moment. So momentary refers to not enduring for a second moment beyond the time of its occurrence. So things that coming in, your body's coming into existence and going out at the very same time. It doesn't sort of go, might seem to you that it's like here and then it's not here, like it's one moment and the second moment is not. It's not like that. It's actually the first moment doesn't last. So it's not like seconds on a clock, right? When you can look at it and you go, or minutes on a clock, now there's 1 minute. It takes all this time when it gets to the next minute. It'll look like that to you naturally. It seems that way. And that's one, you could say that's one form of impermanence. You can really sort of look at it and go, yeah, I can understand that. But actually, it's even more subtle than that. Those moments don't actually come into a second moment. They go out in the first. So everything is changing. And this term, impermanence, has got some principles involved with it. They call it, you know, the 3 core principles of impermanence. The first is this momentary change, what I've just been talking about. The second is what they call dependent arising. So the first moment of any change depends upon a moment that came before it. And this impermanence is, in other words, tied to dependent arising, which is tied to what we call emptiness of inherent existence. Again, meaning there isn't anything that exists without this momentariness. Anything produced depends upon something else, therefore it's going to fall apart. This is not such bad news. It's just the way it is. So one of the things it means is that when you're suffering, it's going to change. You can't just keep suffering in terms of your gross understanding of it, an easy understanding. For instance, you don't just keep a headache. The headache will change over time, and then you get these gaps where you're sort of okay, and then it might come back again. But it's always going to change. So simply, if you look at this simply, it's just anything physical and mental will change. It's a natural process, you can't do anything about. Because phenomena are impermanent, we can actually change mental states deliberately, and you can also change physical states deliberately. We know this because many people go down to the gym, they don't like the way they look. You can go and get surgery, you can go to the gym, right? You change your shape. You can also change your mind. Perhaps that's the good news. The bad news is you're going to die. You can't stop it. It's just going to happen. Well, what we'll talk about, so impermanence exists in these two ways. And it's one way is called gross impermanence, and one is called subtle impermanence. There are different meanings for these two terms, but simply put, gross impermanence, which we'll talk about right now, is impermanence or change that is easy to understand. And what it primarily refers to is obvious change. And the most obvious change is the change of this life and then death. It's called coarse impermanence. And here we see somebody who's died and then covered up roughly with dirt. So impermanence here means in terms of the continuum. So before this person was alive, so he's on the continuum of life. Then he died. The continuum stopped. And his life stopped. It's called, as we know, death. And that's called coarse impermanence. You can actually go around the streets and see houses knocked down. Actually, a lot of trees fell down in the storm. That's coarse impermanence. But all the water came rushing up and changed everything. That's coarse impermanence. Sudden changes that we're all aware of. And we see that, things have changed. Not remaining like after death. The person of this life has come to an end. So coarse impermanence refers to the observable changes that you can see with our eyes. So what use is that knowledge to us? So from a Buddhist perspective, it motivates what is called renunciation. Renunciation basically means that you want to give up the causes of suffering. So seeing death should motivate you to go, okay, what usually happens when death takes place? Anybody had somebody close to them die? What happens to you?
Stop breathing.
You stop breathing, the dead have stopped breathing. And it's not usually a time that we rejoice in,
no,
is it?
You get sad.
You get sad for quite a long time. And the grief can really affect you mentally, physically, emotionally. That's called suffering.
The same with people's houses when lost their houses in Lismore and now losing their houses again.
That's right, in the storm, right? So lots of changes took place and you can get quite upset with that. That being upset is called suffering. Now that suffering has got causes. There are external causes like your house being washed away, and there are internal causes way we're thinking about it. So renunciation is about, okay, the major cause of my suffering is not the house being washed away or burnt down. It's what's going on in my mind. Can I do something about that? And the answer is, yes, you can. Why? Because everything is changeable. Your mental states are changeable. You can change them. So renunciation is saying, I will change those mental states so that I don't suffer unnecessarily. Because it doesn't mean that you have to suffer because your house gets washed away or burnt down. That doesn't follow. In fact, you know, oftentimes you see on television, isn't it, where the house is burnt down in fires and people say, thank goodness we're still all alive. You also see other people getting really upset. And if you ask them, so what's the go here? So one person is looking at themselves and they thank goodness I'm alive. The other is looking at the house burnt down and looking at the loss and moaning about it, upset about it. So one attention has gone outwards, one attention has gone inwards. So I remember the time when Willie Nelson's house burnt down. He was so happy. He rushed inside, he grabbed his pound of smoking, his weed and his guitar, and he knew the insurance was paid off on the house. Great. But it just depends, right? Maybe we've got to have those.
When we're actually dying ourselves, if we don't know what's going to happen, we could be scared.
Yeah. And if you've led a really good life, you could be quite happy. So really, this is what impermanence is sort of getting at here. From a Buddhist, if you're into spiritual training, knowledge of course impermanence should bring about a state of renunciation. So what are you, the mind of renunciation is you're giving up something, right? Giving up the causes of suffering. What's the major cause of suffering in terms of impermanence? Does anybody, some people might know.
Attachment.
Attachment to what?
To anything.
Okay. So an attachment is an overestimation of something. So what's being overestimated here is the impermanent quality of all these physical and mental phenomena, and it's putting on to permanence. So we grasp at permanence where there is none. In other words, we want the phenomena that are changeable to stay the same. They can't, they won't, and they don't. That's what we call believing in permanence where there isn't any. Trying to hold on to these things. When you do that, you create more suffering for yourself because phenomena don't exist that way. So I'll put this quote up, which I really like. This comes from a book called The Words of My Perfect Teacher. And the quote says, impermanence is everywhere, yet I still think things will last. I have reached the gates of old age, yet I still pretend I am young. I like this because I think it's all about me. So bless me and misguided beings like me that we may truly understand impermanence. Now, impermanence plays out in a number of different ways. So I'm just going to show you five different ways and talk about each one briefly. And what I put up here is a picture of the twin towers and when that plane crashed into and exploded. So this is called the impermanence of destruction. Like I said, you can go down the streets in Brisbane, you'll see buildings getting knocked down, you'll see trees being cut down because of the storm. That's the impermanence of destruction. It's really simple, you can see it with your eyes. And it really points to the different changes that are taking place around us in the world. There's another type of impermanence called the impermanence of cultural trends and attitudes. So there are beliefs that we've had in the past that have changed and we have new beliefs about them today. That's a cultural change. It's a change of attitude. This goes on all the time. A third one is called the impermanence of separation. So this refers to any two things that come together. So your body has come together through causes and conditions. That means they're going to separate. And you'll see this taking place oftentimes with a corpse. So there's a place in America, what's it, do you remember what it's called? The body farm. So what people donate their bodies, they put those bodies out there on this farm, and they put cameras on them, and they just photograph.
It's forensics.
Forensics, and they do the whole disintegration process. And they watch it. It helps them understand what happens to a corpse as it disintegrates, and also reveals them something about how they died. So what's really fascinating about that material is that people watch that and they speed it up. So I've seen ones where they have like rabbits. The rabbits died and they put the camera on it. Takes on how long. Sometimes it's like quite a long time. They speed the film up and just watch the rabbit disappear. Yeah, with the possum. Yeah. And in fact, in Thailand, I think they keep some of the bodies in different stages of decomposition. So the monks can go along and look at the body decomposing. And so it helps them to generate renunciation towards the body. Makes them realize that everything falls apart. So relationships fall apart, buildings fall apart, your body falls apart, your mind can even fall apart, and you find yourself in a mental institution. Anything that comes together will fall apart. Then we call sudden impermanence. And again, this is where something takes place very suddenly, quickly, and unexpectedly. Like, for instance, you might walk out here and then suddenly go on the footpath and somebody comes along with a bike and says, bam, hits you. But suddenly, sudden change. Or everything's right today. You go to the doctors tomorrow for something, you think it's normal, and they tell you, I'm sorry, you've got stage 4 cancer. But suddenly, and it can have a big impact on you. And lastly, we have, I think, what's called the nature of impermanence. And this is what I've been talking about, that everything arises due to causes and conditions. And it arises like that means it's going to change. It changes. Even at the atomic level of your body, the atoms change. Everything's like that. And like I said, the thing that I like about the watching those films with the rabbits and the corpses or even flowers, you go on YouTube and just watch it and see a flower come up and then go down and disappear. And that's what's going to happen to us. It's like that for us too. It's no different. And that that change that you can watch when the films are sped up, that's called subtle impermanence. I think we're really lucky to be able to see it like that, because it's not, we look at each other like this, it doesn't look like we're changing, does it? We look stable, but sort of permanent, stable, but we're not. That not is referring to subtle impermanence. And this is what we see, the momentariness of things. Disintegrated, even the time of the first moment. But I see before, we say like one and then two, and it's like there's a gap between one and two, but in terms of this, there's no gap. It goes one out, and then we say two. And two is just the moment of the disintegration of the first moment. What's really great about this is it's called the undermined inherent existence. So, so I see there's a few new people here. So, inherent existence does not exist. That's the first thing I should say to you. There's no such thing as any inherent existence. However, our senses perceive it. So, we're perceiving something that does not exist. And what is this? It's like this stability. Stability where there is nothing, where there is none. Where, like you and I, when I look at you, I see you right there. What does not appear to me is that you depend upon causes and conditions. You two do, all of us do. I do not see your disintegration. I see your permanence. You don't seem to be changing at all to me. And I'm sure when you're looking at me, I don't seem to be changing at all either. My hand going up and down. And yet we are. So in other words, our sense of outcome is leading us in a way. We're seeing permanence where there is none. We're seeing inherent existence where there is none. This subtle impermanence destroys that whole idea. If you get this into your head, go, oh my gosh, there's nothing stable about me or anything around me. Change works against inherent existence. If things were inherently existent, they could not change. And yet, like I said, everything changes. And so this, the soldier says this, but also the Buddha himself, he says, understanding subtle impermanence prepares the mind for insight into selflessness. And this is the direct antidote to ignorance. So this word selflessness is quite interesting too. So you and I, we all have a self. You know, we talk about ourselves. So it's easy to say I, we're talking about me, and that's self. This self does exist, but we can misapprehend how it exists. We can misunderstand how we exist, in other words. So the self, yourself, is it impermanent or permanent? That's the impermanent, doesn't it? Don't you change? We say, I've changed my mind, and so forth. Well, actually, if you have a... if you just reflect a bit, I mean, we have changed. I mean, you've changed since you were babies to the age you are right now, and so have I. So we say, I have changed. But when we talk about our sense of self, doesn't it seem that there's a self that was a baby and there's a self that's you right now? It must be.
Yeah, because you're looking at yourself as a baby, or you
remember. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Then you say, I was a baby, and then they might say, well, I'm 60, or I'm 70, or I'm 40. So there's an I when there's a baby, and there's an I right now, isn't there? When you look at that sense of I, how does it appear to you? You just say, like I. Talk about yourself, didn't you?
It appears like there's someone who was in charge of the baby and who's in charge of me right now, or who was in charge of the person who had breakfast. Like there was someone who was always in charge.
That's right. Someone who was always there. That happens, or that feel different. So that I, it's always been there, right? Since you're a baby to right now. Does that I seem to have changed to you? Yeah, I'm the same. I don't know. It's the same. And in fact, I remember once saying to a woman at a farm, I asked them, they look really old to me. I said, they were old. I said, how old do you feel? And the woman said to me, 70. I was really shocked, right? Because I was like 30 something, and I still felt like I was about 18. And I was going, I think I'm like 18, 19. That's how I am. Myself seems to be. But so I was about 12 years out of that. And I was so shocked that she was right on the spot. You know, so, I feel like I'm 70 years. Oh, I am 70 years old. I feel like I'm 70. So like Sandra says, no, and I'm the same. I go, no, the sense of I that's, it's not the I that's the baby, it's not the I that's 70 years old now. There's a sense of I that's...
But that sense of I feels more like a continuous strand rather than a one thing.
It feels like a one thing. If I think about it, I'll go, yeah, it must be a continuous strand. But if I don't think about it, it's just, no, it's me. I'm right here. But either way, we have these different ways of thinking about ourselves, right? But what I want to say to you is that whatever the self that does exist has to be impermanent. It can't be permanent, like this way it seems to me, like unchanging. The self that was in the baby and the self that's right here, it's never really changed. I mean, lots of things have changed, but I really haven't. That's how my self appears to be. It can be quite different for other people, of course. So this is what I find, you know, what's interesting about this. Now, in terms of coarse impermanence and subtle impermanence, when you start to think about the stuff, you start off with easy, meaning the coarse impermanence. So things fall down, collapse, break, and people die. You start with that, that's obvious to us. Then you sort of look at that a little bit deeper, and then you come to subtle impermanence. But there must be this really subtle change going on all the time that I'm basically not aware of. And the fact that I remember reading a Dharma book, I was saying, thank goodness we're not aware of it. Because imagine the shock if you were to suddenly look into the mirror and see that, my God, when I was 5 and the age I am now, like it's a change in bits. In fact, I remember going to a nursing home and I went to see one person, there was another old woman lying on the bed really close by. I looked around and there's a big photo on the wall of this really beautiful woman and her husband, and he was in military uniform, that must be First World War, that got married. She was a glamour, right? So I look around and that is, I couldn't put the two people together. But this is really, this woman was really old and really curled up on the bed, you know, in a baby shape, you know, you get really old. And the panic that was in her eyes, just lying there, like just stunned, looking up at me like this. I look at her and I look at the photo and go, oh my God. If we live long enough, that's what will happen to us. It's just this momentary change, bit by bit, bit by bit, bit by bit. Not recognized. We think we're basically the same person. But we're not. So in terms from, like I said, if you want to study this, of course you want to really think, why would I want to think about this or study it? Begin with what's easy. You begin with, like I said, death is obvious change. Trees falling down, that's obvious. They look into what's not so obvious, the subtle changes that are going on all the time. And everything around us will disintegrate. Everything will vanish just because of impermanence. Yes.
Years and years ago, when I was learning Spanish and about you know, all the various verbs and things like that, and we're learning about houses and the way that you conjugate houses. There's, in Spanish, there's stable things and unstable things.
Okay.
And houses are unstable. Whereas in our culture, we say like safe as houses, or we used to, hardly anyone says safe as houses now. But that really struck me as a cultural difference that in Spanish, the whole thing of buildings and houses is just inherently unstable. Mm-hmm. Where, yeah, it's really.
That was a good point, Miffy. So I'm going to bring up now about why should we even think about all this stuff? Any ideas? Then we'll start, we've got two types of impermanence. We've got the coarse, which is the obvious one, and then we've got subtle. That's not obvious. We need to think about that. So why would we like become familiar with coarse impermanence?
So we don't freak out before the cyclone.
Well, that's a good example. That's right. So we know there's massive change is going to come because the cyclone's coming. So what did we do? We got ready for it, didn't we?
Some people panicked.
Yeah, some people panicked, but most didn't. You know, then, okay, there's a cyclone coming, so we need to do all these things. And some people did, didn't they? If you're rational about it, you'd go, okay, like for us, take all the rubbish bins inside because the wind's going to pick them up and blow them all over the place. You don't want that. Take all the chairs and stuff away from around the property because the wind can pick it up, throw it into your windows. We don't want that. take all the pot plants and all these things, right? Most of us did these things because we thought about go, man, when the cyclone comes, this could happen. Do I want that to happen? Yeah. Well, no, not if I can stop it. So, you know, you do the best you can, don't you? So this is the same thing, right? Once you go, okay, so I'm going to die. That's for certain. What can I do between now and then? What can I do to prepare for my death? Because I don't want to be like those people who knew the cyclone was coming and did nothing. Thought I'll be right, right, and then found that they weren't right. Yeah, just go, yeah, you know, it's like I said, the most, I actually was on the bus the other day, I was thinking about this, looking around the people and going, and I met this guy at the bus stop, you know, he was talking about politics and stuff like that, and I nearly said to him, man, the only thing you can be certain of is in this life is your death. And that's how I've knocked it right down and go, you want certainty? Be certain you'll die. Sometimes I say, paying taxes, I go, no, I've never paid taxes. Can't be certain of that at all. Right? Lots of people can escape paying taxes, right? But you can't escape death. That's the one thing that's for certain. Now, the next thing you can ask them, so what am I going to do about that? So this is what thinking about course and permanence is meant to do. You're meant to think about that. Instead of having this dread about it, being afraid, you know, is there something I can do? Instead of being afraid that the cyclone's coming, is there something I can do? The answer is yes.
River from online, she says, it helps us to move past clinging to ourselves or others, which leads to fear and sadness during the unwinding of all things.
Excellent, River. That's right. So this idea of confronting our death is to overcome our fears towards it. So one of the ways of doing that is to understand what death actually is. What takes place when we die? Does something take place after? We need to know these things. Most of us make assumptions that, no, when we die, that's it. That's the end. We ask, is that correct? Is that true? Is that how it works with other things? When other things die, is that the end? So we do that first. That's to confront this existential dread about our upcoming death, right? So we don't have fear about it. Whenever we look into subtle impermanence, that's really interesting because then you might find out, like, who does die? Who actually dies? If the eye is arising and disintegrating moment to moment, and you can't actually put your finger on anything at the most subtlest level. There's nothing to grasp at. It's only at the gross level everything appears stable and permanent. Like I said, you go beneath it, it's not. It's undergoing change rapidly, so fast we can't even see it. And so what's the fear got to do with this? What use is the fear? Yeah, well, fear will arise from that, that's for sure, Helen. That's right. So there's plenty you can do about meeting your own death and dying either really joyfully or in a state of peace or without any regrets whatsoever. That's really accomplishable. But even further than that is to die with wisdom. Then it's very interesting from that perspective. So let's just our first, but before I do, just some, do you guys have anything you'd like to say? Okay, let's do our meditation. Just quick meditation. Last less than 5 minutes. Now please again just get comfortable in your seat. You need to have your back straight, shoulders relaxed. You keep your eyes open or closing. So sitting comfortably with your spine straight. Let your body breathe itself. And as the body breathes itself, just notice the breath flowing naturally. So we're going to meditate on impermanence, and in particular, subtle impermanence. So dedicate this practice to awakening compassion for yourself and other beings, to seeing reality clearly. So what if every thought, sensation, and object were dissolving, even as they appear to you? In fact, all phenomena disintegrate like this, and no external force is needed. Now, this means that impermanence is not something wrong, it's just the nature of existence itself. But like a candle flame that appears steady, but constantly transforms. Each flicker arises and vanishes within the same causal flow. So why does this ongoing disintegration challenge our sense of permanence and solidity? Because the grasping requires a fixed target. But reality flickers like flame light. There is nothing to cling to. So today, have you mistaken feelings that are transient to be permanent and unchanging, to stay the same? Can you recall a frustration that dissolved when it was observed, like your breath dissolving into space? So how might understanding subtle disintegration soften your reactions to pleasure or pain? Like watching the light rays cast by the flickering candle flame, you'd engage without any fixation, knowing that each sensation is already passing. What we need to remember is that the cause of existence is the cause of cessation. Everything that's coming in is going out. Everything is like this. I'm breathing in, exhaling. And let your eyes pop open and your awareness come back into the room. Now, next section of the class, we're going to be talking about a type of thinking and behavior that goes completely against this knowledge of impermanence. Called grasping at the eight worldly concerns, or grasping at the eight worldly dharmas. So it's called mundane concern and worldly dharma. So this has particular meanings. So I'll go through the meaning first. So mundane means ordinary. Worldly means unstable. And dharma means truly existent. Meaning, so truly this means things exist in the way they appear to you, yet at the same time they're really unstable, and they're the ordinary things. So to grab or to believe that these ordinary things are, which are unstable, actually are stable and exist in the way they appear to us, that gets us into trouble. And there's sort of four particular things that we believe to be stable when they're actually unstable. We think that they exist in the way they appear to us, but they don't. And this goes completely against what we call dharma. So the dharma is basically the truth that the Buddha taught. There's just another word for a teaching. So this, the teachings of the Buddha go against this idea of the worldly dharma. And what the idea is as people who call ourselves Buddhists or practitioners or training in these teachings, what we've got to work out is, am I actually practicing actual dharma or am I practicing worldly dharma? Which one am I practicing? Because they can look the same, but they're very different. So these are these eight worldly dharmas or the eight worldly concerns that I'll put up now. So on one side we are seeking pleasure, gain, praise and fame. On the other side we want to avoid their opposites, pain, loss, disparagement and disrepute. We do this because we overestimate the pleasure, the gain, the praise and the fame. We overestimate the good qualities of them. And on the other side, we do the same. We overestimate again. So we go, oh, I don't want that. That's a real problem there. I was talking to my brother-in-law yesterday on the phone. He was telling me about his medical problems, what's going on with him. And he's doing the self-analysis, right? And he's not going to the doctor. So he's talking about all these different pains and he's trying to work out like what's going on. And I was going like, and he doesn't want to really deal with it because it's, I think this is a real problem here. I've got these problems. And I was thinking about, wow, this is like the opposite. It's like the Buddhist teaching goes, pain is telling you something valuable here. You need to go to the doctor. The pain is telling you, go to the doctor. And he's going, no, I don't want to feel this pain. I want to work it out right here. Sitting down, and I go, wow, aversion to pain and what it might mean, so I'm not going to the doctor.
So then you take a painkiller fix.
Yeah, this is what he did. This is what he said. It was really good painkillers, but blah, blah, blah. And so I took that, and my mate said to try this, so I did that, and I feel much better now. So I'll go, mate, the causes are still there. You just covered them over. Yeah, so this was an interesting thing about pain. It doesn't necessarily mean we have to avoid it. It could tell us something meaningful. So each side actually has its beneficial side and its negative side, its other side.
Yeah, in the hospital, they don't give you painkillers till they've figured out what's wrong with you because they can't
That's
tell
right.
it. You can't say where is it
That's
sore.
right. That's right. Yeah. So now I'm going to say, now the problem here is it's not... Actual, the problems are not pleasure, gain, praise, and fame. That's not the problem. The problem is the attachment to them, the overestimation of them. That's the thing. It's the same here with the pain, the loss, disparagement, disrepute. That's not the problem. It's your overestimation of them. So when you overestimate, you go against what we call the Dharma, the truth. You're dealing with stuff you've made up. Your mind has made it up and you think this is true. So you get involved with it. Yeah, so it's called an attachment, overestimating. In response to these eight ruling dharmas, Aryanagarjuna, in his letter to a friend, says, "You who know the world, take gain and loss, or bliss and pain, or kind words and abuse, or praise and blame. These eight mundane concerns, make them the same and don't disturb your mind." So attachment will disturb your mind because it's an overestimation of this phenomena, and because they don't exist in the way your mind is projected on them, you're going to get shocks all the time, right? Because the things don't exist in the way your mental projections have made them appear to you. But there's a way to stop that. And Nagarjuna says, make them the same. In other words, look at them with equanimity. See their equalness. That way you won't be disturbed by them because you won't have attachment. So again, like I'm saying, it's not that pleasure, gain, praise, and fame are the problem, and it's not that pain, loss, disparagement, and dispute are the problem. It's how we're accessing them to the mind. If we bring attachment into it, we've got a problem. If you see them clearly, with equanimity, you don't have a problem. But how do we do that? Well, first of all, we have to understand that we're actually overestimating either side, right? That's what we call attachment. We're overestimating the qualities of this phenomenon, something about it. So in the teachings of the Buddha, you have a lot of ways of overcoming that overestimation. You have practices done in what they call the small scope and the middle scope and great scope. And so the way I've done here is taken each of these worldly concerns, worldly dharmas, and looked at it through the lens of the small scope, the great scope, and then through wisdom itself. So the two lower scopes are what you call method. The last is wisdom. So I've tried to give you different ways of how to deal with this overestimation that produces the attachment. So when we come to pleasure, remember we're overestimating the pleasure. Always remember that when you're dead, it's no use to you. Everything that you've ever experienced as pleasurable is gone when you're dead. In fact, it's gone pretty quickly after you've experienced it, if you just think about it. I don't even think about it, just try to remember. Like, if you had something delicious this morning, the pleasure's gone now, isn't it? It's a pleasure that comes and goes like so quickly that it would be foolish to hang on to grasp to it. Most of us try and do that. So again, this is like recollecting impermanence. Pleasure changes. It doesn't remain stable. So that's one. In the great scope, where you're not so much focused on yourself, you're focused on others, that whatever pleasure you feel, to not be attached to it, say, think to yourself, oh, this has only come about through the benefit of others. Let them have it back. I offer it back to them.
Yeah, often when things are going well or I'm really enjoying things, there's always this thought in my mind, so what's the point?
Yeah. That's right. Now, the point is to develop good mental qualities. Because you can really develop bad mental qualities, couldn't you? But just
yeah,
like,
just more craving.
Yeah, more craving. Well, I like this. Do more of it. But like I said, it's all gone when you die. What's the point? And I often think of when people are, what do you call it? If you like, I used to call it food porn. Yeah, there's all these shows on television about food, eating food, and I was there. You know what happens after you eat the food, don't you? Huh? So what's the point?
With that second point, I find that sometimes I'm a bit sneaky and go, well, I'm sharing that pleasure with others, so I'll just have more and more of it. And then I'm like, uh-oh, didn't quite get that right.
Well, yeah, another way, so one of the other things that the Buddha says that, you know, your body is made up of all these organisms, and that whatever you eat, those organisms feed upon. So you can take it like, I'm imbibing the food to offer it to all of the organisms that make up the phenomenon we call the body, which keep me alive. And so it's not on me. Because again, if you start looking for me, you don't find any me that's really enjoying it. But there are lots of organisms in your body that really need nourishment. And so you are nourishing them, which gives you good health and so forth. So you offer it to those living beings. And lastly, so they often said, pleasure is like a bubble. Right? You know, like if you listen to, when you're a kid, you blow those bubbles, they look great. The sun reflects off them. Pleasure is like that, just because it's just gone. They're like soap bubbles. Yep. So that's how you stop overestimating the pleasure. Now, the opposite side is pain. So now you might overestimate pain. Three antidotes there. Always remember that pain changes, never stays the same. In fact, nothing stays the same. You've got to remind yourself of that. And what you can do is watch it, look for the changes. What's really interesting is very hard to find pain when you actually look for it. So like I said, everything changes. And just that's the major thing to remember. It's really simple. Whenever you experience pain, realize that when you go like me, that's the cherishing of me. And so you go, well, actually, it's the cherishing, it's the self-cherishing that's been hurt. But good. Self-cherishing should be hurt. It's the major source of all my problems. All my problems have arisen because I've only thought about me. I've made myself the most important person in the whole wide world. That idea should be hurt. It's wrong. So it's not I, it's the idea, the cherishing of I. That's a wrong idea. That produced all the pain, now the pain returns. Good. My practice is working. Self-cherishing has been hurt. And another thing, so I've taken all these different phenomena here for the wisdom side. Because in the books, there are lots of metaphors like this and similes. And if you go through them, you can go, oh, that's a great way of looking at it. That's a great way. So pain is like this visual aberration. It looks really strong and real, but in fact, it's not. So like, for instance, if you're experiencing pain anywhere in your body, it must be in your body, right?
Yeah.
Would you think? Yeah, well, okay. So is there a part of your body that's not experiencing pain?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Find the line between that part that's not experiencing the pain and the part that's experiencing the pain.
Here. Right, yeah.
Okay, so here you go, where exactly here? When you go to look for the line between the pain and what's not painful, it blurs. You can't actually find it. This is an aberration. You think it's as real as it feels to you, like we just go right there, right there. That's how real it is. You look right there, like you're gonna, it's very hard to find there actually, and you start looking for exactly there. The lovely thing about this is just trying it out changes your whole relationship to the pain. That's the major thing. You're doing something different here now. You're really looking. The looking changes it. Oh, so this guy, again, the same fellow on the bus. I was thinking that, you know, what you put your attention on becomes your reality. So the more specific you can put your attention and really look, it gets very interesting then. But when you don't, it's just like bad. That's a really gross way of looking at it. It's a very casual way. Okay. Where exactly? So you refine your attention, looking for where is it painful? Where's the line? Where can I say that is painful? That's not. Like you change your relationship to pain. You're not overestimating it. You're trying to actually try and find where is this thing? What's it look like? What's it actually feel like? Your relationship, your experience will change. Material gain. You can't keep it. So everything Trump was trying to hold on to, and everything every other rich person, it's always left behind. You can't keep it. You can't go with it. Elon Musk. You know, whoever the rich people are, they all leave it when they're dead. It'll be the same with us. You leave your clothing, your shoes, like everything. So from this way, other way of thinking, you think everything that I possess is yours. It all came from the kindness of you anyway. It actually belongs to you. I was just holding on to it for a few moments. That's all. It actually belongs to you. So this is your attitude. The clouds have no essence. So clouds, when you look up from one of the top or the bottom, they always look quite solid. But they have no solidity. And material gain is like that too. You think it can provide you with what you think it can, and many times it can't. So again, I remember a film called The Serpent's Egg. But you know, I used to think, you know, money, like get the money and you're okay. And so in this film, money lost all value. So these guys are coming into the pub to get themselves beer to drink, and a wheelbarrow full of cash. And that really shocked me. I thought, oh, of course, they can just say, you know, what's the thing they do? They take away the value of money, or they change the value of money. So
print extra zeros on it.
Oh, print more money, and the money you've actually got becomes worth less and less and less and less because there's more and more money. And so value, money doesn't have any inherent value. If you actually look at it, it used to be just paper. I think before that was coins. Sometimes it's shells. Right? It's just an agreement we make. If the agreements change, it's worthless. So there's no safety there. So the money itself has no actual inherent value. No essential value. You see this all the time with the stock market, don't you? People buy stocks and they go, wow, I'm so rich. And then overnight it changes and then I'm so poor. It's like, God, I've lost my fortune. It's like that. Now, overestimating loss. So everything that comes together will fall apart. So whatever you have, you will lose it. It's just the way it is. So what does it say? No need to get upset, right? It's going to happen. But so that when you do feel bad about it, again, you go, that's self-cherishing. It doesn't have to be me. You have this feeling of loss. You go, that's the loss that self-cherishing is taking. Great, good. You're the major hindrance. You're the You're the major cause of all my problems. You always overestimated the wealth. Now you get your comeuppance. So has anybody ever seen a drop of dew on a leaf? You know, the Buddhist text often talk about seeing it in the morning. It looks gorgeous. When the sunlight comes, it just goes. Yeah, phenomenal, just like that. There's nothing to hold to. So all these phenomena we're talking about, they are conditioned phenomena, conditioned things. It's saying that all of these phenomena are illusory. Meaning they don't exist in the way they appear. And they're all marked by fabrications, meaning our ideas about them. We make up ideas about them, and we think our ideas about them are true and real. And the phenomena exist in the way that we think about them. They don't.
Meg from online asked if you could just explain again, every loss belongs to self-cherishing.
Yeah. Okay, so the self-cherishing mind is the mind that has put the self front and center stage. And what it tries to do is bring everything into the self to make it feel satisfied and to keep it away from anything that harms it. This is a mistaken mind, self-cherishing. So whenever these losses take place, we often think, it's like I, isn't it? Right? We grasp at I and go, oh my God, I have lost this and that. So instead of doing that, go, no, it's this mind that has overestimated the phenomena. It's lost. It was wrong to begin with, and now it's come back and bitten it, you know? Yeah, good. So I found that if we do this, it makes a massive difference to yourself. When you know, we say the horrible things happen to you, and you say, good, it changes it immediately. And the good is that self-cherishing has taken the loss. So you've got to, two things here. You've got to go, there's an I and there's the attitude, the mind. And they're not one and the same thing, right? I think. I is the thinker and the thought, they're different. Self-cherishing is seen from the Mahayana perspective to be the root of all the suffering. But that has taken the loss, not me. All my problems have come about in this wrong way of looking at phenomena. So it's this wrong attitude, it has taken the loss. Good. Wrong attitudes should be lost, should be knocked down, any way you can possibly knock them down. I'm okay. I don't know, you get to see
me. Does it kind of make more sense if you bring in the middle bit of karma, doesn't it? So you have self-cherishing and a mistaken view, and then you do actions to just look after number one and ignore everybody else, and then later on that comes back at you. So you're saying comes back at your self-cherishing.
Yeah, so there's another practice called the Wheel of Sharp Weapons, which is, again, how to overcome the self-cherishing mind. So whenever something bad happens to you, it's like the Wheel of Karma has come around and you did this bad action, now the bad action, the results of that bad action return to you. Self-cherishing, the bad mental state.
Was the motivator of
Yeah, that. And so now the negative outcome of that bad mental state has come back. So who's it come back to? The creator of it, self-cherishing. Overestimating praise. Recollect that whatever rises, falls. So when we're praised, what, we feel big, right? We're inflated. Remember, it's going to deflate. Again, it says, again, so now we're in the middle way. Everything I possess, whatever people say about me, it's said by somebody else. So if you're praised by someone else, you think about how kind they are. Give the merit back to them. They're the ones speaking nicely. They're the ones using their speech skillfully. The merit actually belongs to them. They are creating sources of happiness for themselves. This is wonderful. But actually, praise is like an echo in the gorge. It really doesn't. What does it bring you? Completely. Yeah, really nothing there. Just sounds, aren't they? So praise and disparagement, of course, you know, look at this, like being criticized and so forth. It's just like the other side, isn't it? It just sounds. So I remember seeing this. So we'll go through. So you know, nothing stays the same. So when you get praised one day, tomorrow you're going to be criticized. You criticize today, tomorrow you'll be praised. It's up and down. It just changes all the time. That's just how things are. Again, we say defeat is mine, victory to others. Again, we're talking about the self-cherishing. You never say it like, oh, this is the thing that'll be said. Is that I is a person that has different mental states. Some of them are not good. Self-cherishing is one of the biggest problems for a Mahayana practitioner. So it is defeated when it's criticized, when you hear criticism. It's not me, the person. It's this mental state. Victory to others. Thank goodness that I've been attacking myself, cherishing. I need people to do that. I rarely do it myself. So I remember, you know, when you think, so give an example. So with praise and criticism. So when the Chinese military defeated the Tibetans, so they got all the Tibetan people to line up in the streets, and the Tibetan army marched down the street, and they got everybody to clap, to go, thank goodness the victorious Chinese army are freed us from our serfdom and these corrupt monks and everything, right? So the Tibetan people did it joyfully. Do you know why? So normally when you clap, what does it mean?
It's support.
It's support, isn't it? It's great. Right? And that's what the Chinese thought. And most people think that, right? But for the Tibetans, when they clap their hands like this, it makes a sound to drive away demons. So they were very, very happy to clap their hands as the Chinese military walked down the street. So it shows you, like, these phenomena have no actual inherent existence. It all depends. Again, it's just like a loud noise. It comes and it's gone. Like, you know, we had the storms, the thunder, little lightning, some noises and that. It's not here now, is it? This comes and goes. Praise and blame are just like that. Fame, again, fame and success are left behind. You think about the people who are alive now, and the vast majority of them have been and gone. We don't remember any of them, or very few of them, in your history book.
Yeah, you just see all these
statues
of
yeah.
dead guys and don't even know
who they
are.
What they did. Yeah, that's right. Again, but every type of success and merit just now belongs to others. I can only become famous through others. Others are like, you know, if I ran up and said, I'm famous, I'm famous, you go, everybody go, well, who are you? Like, how come? You know, it's only when you look at some of the others go, appreciate it, then you become famous, right? So they made you famous, you go, you recognize and go, thank you. But all that belongs
to
you.
You've got to look after your fans.
Yeah, fame again is just like a reflection. has no real substance. Now, when you're not seen in that light, remember that your disrepute is changeable. So you see this again and again throughout history. Some of people become famous and they're not liked, then they come back again. This often happens in music. And you think about the Bee Gees. Right? They went through three different phases where they were in, then they were out, then they were in, then they were out, then they were in. Happens all the time. Again, you take defeats and failures, you always put it on the self-cherishing thought. It's not, you don't put it on you. It's the same with the fame. With the good side, it's not you. Again, it's just a flash, comes and goes. So to reverse these eight worldly concerns, you can use all of those different techniques. But you use impermanence. That's the most, it's the easiest one of all. Nothing is stable about this. Then when it comes to self-cherishing, the second one, you go, everything good belongs to you and the other people who praise you and do all these great things for you. Whatever else feel great about me, it came from you. Give it back, rejoice, praise them, think well of the others. When it's the negative side, it's not them, it's not you, it's a self-cherishing thought. That's good. It needs to be harmed. It's not a valid thought. So you harm it, you thank it. Lastly, use as many metaphors and similes as you can recollect and their meanings. So there's always techniques here. Never forget, right? There's lots of techniques. Whenever you get a negative mental stuff, there's stuff you can do about it. Again, just because things are changeable.
Actually, that I find really helpful, because otherwise thinking about impermanence or death can just kind of make me freeze and shut down, whereas knowing that there's somewhere to go with the emotion or with the thought is helpful. So that there's something to do.
Yeah, there's something we can do. You know, the Buddhist definition of the function of the person. You know, the first thing we ask, what's the person? You know, the I designated to the body and mind. That's it. What's the job of a person? What's the function? To act. To act. So we like how all things are impermanent. Act. Even if it's just the acceptance of it, that's an act. All things are impermanent. All things are changeable. Just rest in a changeable state. And there are things I can do. Yes, plenty.
Like preparing for the cyclone, and then we had a whole day to sit around and wait for it.
Yeah, well, that's dead right. That's what happens, isn't it? You do a lot of activity and you wait. What's the changes? Okay, last meditation, folks. Again, just get comfortable in your seat. I think we're doing this meditation for the welfare of all living beings. Then we've all engaged in actions, different types of actions. Just ask yourself whether a recent activity you engaged in, was it driven by compassion or was it driven by attachment to your outcomes? So the practice Dharma skillfully and purely is when your actions are free from craving for comfort, reputation, or pleasure. Whereas actions driven by the worldly concerns perpetuate the suffering we seek to escape from. So by renouncing these eight worldly concerns and embracing compassion and wisdom aligns us with the three principal aspects of the path. The renunciation, the bodhicitta or mind of enlightenment, and wisdom. Well, the Dharma itself is like pure water that quenches our deepest thirst. Whereas the non-Dharma of attachment and aversion towards worldly concern is like salt water It temporarily satisfies, but ultimately it deepens craving. So I wonder how practice might change if we were freed from desires for praise or recognition. Now that I've introduced you to these eight worldly concerns, you think you'll be able to notice them arising in your daily life. And how might an awareness based on intention transform current challenges? It is with the right motivation, difficulties become opportunities for authentic practice. So before acting, just check. Is this driven by worldly concern or for genuine compassion? Examining your motivations will free you from the sufferings that take place and establish you on a path to freedom. Now breathe in through your nostrils. Exhale. Get your eyes flush open. So as a takeaway, just remember that impermanence is just it's a catalyst for change. Change is taking place anyway. You can play a part in it and create greater happiness for yourselves and less suffering. There are these eight worldly concerns that you were introduced to. These actually hinder spiritual practice, but you do have antidotes for each of them.
Eddie, just one thing, you know, that impermanence is a catalyst for change that I thought I'd share with everyone. So this centre, we've been in this building here for, I don't know, 15, 17 years. And with various communications with the neighbours, but with our with the cyclone coming, I managed to contact the neighbour on the corner, which we haven't really had any good communication with since we've been here. And she texted back straight away and said, everything's fine, anything you need at the shops. And then talked to the neighbours behind us. And so now from all of this, now suddenly our little corner is communicating nicely. And it took a big event like this to have a good enough excuse to actually kind of break that barrier there. So, that's a really important thing, especially for a Buddhist center to be able to have harmony with the neighbors. So.
Yeah, so we had this a cyclone. You could look at that from a, you know, one way, but then look at it like this. It actually helped us communicate with the people around us and create a greater harmony. So it sort of says in a way that external events don't have anything really good or bad about them. It's up to us. It's what your mind does with it. But if you're averse to it, well, it'll create something for you. If you are attached to it, it'll create something for you too. If you approach it with compassion, it'll create something for you. So what you bring to the situations, you get back. So next week, this topic is not an easy one. People don't really like it much. So there are six disadvantages for when you do not think about death and impermanence, death and rebirth, but there are six advantages to doing so. So I want to bring that up next week. And then what's the best method to adopt in terms of... that brings the end of our class. So let's dedicate the effort we've all put into sitting here, listening, thinking about it. So join me in saying, Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the Supreme Guru, Bodhicitta, not be a born or rising Guru. May that born have no decline but increase forevermore. And as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, may I too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world. The wish-granting, wish-fulfilling Guru, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world, to the incomparably kind Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. In harmony and spreading the meaning's precious and complete teachings through explanations and practice, you wore the armor of patience and is never discouraged. Incomparable, venerable Guru, to you, I make this request.